the Wildlife Observer Network.
Welcome to another episode of Herpin' Ain't Easy. I'm not sure if we'll double list this with urban wildlife because this specific part of it is not super urban. So we might just do another episode once we get into sort of urban plethodon tips, and I'll refer people back to this episode if it's purely on Herpin' Ain't Easy. But great. In any case, this is one of the best podcasts on herping in the entire world. Do you agree, Mike?
Absolutely.
Hands down. There you go. And we're part of the Wildlife Observer Network, so you can look at all of our fabulous brother and sister podcasts, which are wonderful. And, you know, I wanted to I'll start with a little introduction to what we're going to talk about. Then I'll give you an update on something else. So we had promised a few episodes ago, well, one episode ago, we promised a few episodes about plethodonts and salamanders. And we're going to kick that off today with kind of an introduction to the whole family of these salamanders and why they're so cool. Before we get into that, the last episode, which was our first episode, we talked about sort of the ethics of snake translocation, relocation, release, that kind of thing. I have a sad update, which is that Lucille, as Magnolia named, I know, your nose is going. So my plan had been to hold her for a shed, give her a mouse, let her go in better shape than I found her, right? But I was going to sort of cut it off at 2 weeks and let her go again, if she wasn't eating or anything. And prior to 2 weeks, I kept thinking she was about to shed. She didn't shed. I tried the usual captive snake husbandry tricks you do when a snake can't shed. I put her in the container with warm, wet paper towels and stuff for a while. I could get the, I mean, I knew she wasn't doing great. And I was like, all right, we might just have to release her because she's not going to eat. She's going to do better outside.
Yeah, one doubt, let her go.
Try to give her extra heat. And then I came back from a bike ride and Gigi was like, the snake's dead. So currently she's in my freezer, and I had emailed a friend, who's a herpetologist and said, hey, do you know anyone who'd want this specimen? In case someone wants to do it, like, you know, look at it, do an analysis about the lesions and everything. If they're connected to this, if they are fungal in nature.
Yeah.
And I sent an email to Fish and Boat also. I think it's hard getting people's attention now, given everybody's working from home and scrambling on their jobs in the pandemic. But hopefully some point, she'll get analyzed and make a contribution to science. It is sad, though.
There is.
Yeah. But, hey, on happier notes, we're going to talk about salamanders. So you might have tuned into Herpin' Ain't Easy, and you might have been thinking, surely this podcast is going to be about big, spectacular reptiles and amphibians. Maybe they'll talk about hellbenders. Maybe they'll talk about rattlesnakes. Maybe they'll talk about saltwater crocodiles. King cobras. You know what I'm wearing? This is hard to read.
I can't see it at all.
I want to turn it around. Can you see that?
I see what? Oh, yeah. Look at that. A king cobra. Nice.
This is from the King Cobra Conservancy, which funds like king cobra conservation work in Southeast Asia.
Nice.
So, well, and actually,
two things. Heads up, I'm gonna have kids interrupting. Honey, I'm on a call, so you gotta be quiet, right? Come on in. Come on in. And secondly, I'm gonna show you the shirt that I was wearing just before I put this one on. Since we're sharing shirts, this is worthy. Especially since you mentioned one that I have.
Yeah.
So this is a shirt. I bought this at the place. Can you see that?
Burritos? Hellbender burritos.
Hellbender burritos, baby. This is Davis, West Virginia. Yeah, it's like a bar and restaurant that's right on the river. The backyard is the river that is occupied by hellbenders.
We're going to have to do a hellbender episode, Mike.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's fitting to mention Davis, West Virginia for the plethodon today. So, you know, I got some lifers on that trip. Right in the mountains adjacent. So
nice. But people who are getting excited about the big stuff, we hope we can convince you that the small stuff is way cool also.
Yes.
And I think it's I don't know, Mike. I think it's almost an evolution that a lot of herpers go through, is that we get into it because of the big fun stuff. It's when you're a little kid and you're a nerd, maybe you can impress some people by picking up a big snake and like not being the one, and sort of being the one who's not afraid of it.
But that said, Billy, no lie. I mean, I'm a professional herpetologist, and my spark herp was a plethodontid.
Oh my. All right. Well, let's talk about it. What'd you find?
Well, so when I was young, I was a latchkey kid, right? So I often just didn't go home after school. I just roam around the local little pocket park. And I always had a little notebook, and I loved to draw. I loved to sketch. So I'd like sit along a stream bank and like draw some eroded stream bank with the roots sticking out and stuff. And I would often borrow two cups from one of my neighbors, and I would walk through the stream and I'd scare crayfish. They'd run backwards into one cup, you know?
Sure.
And so I'd capture lots of crayfish and two-line salamanders and redbacks. Often when they're near, you know, during dry conditions, you'll find them in or along the edges of the streams. And so those are the only two salamanders I was used to seeing. And then I flipped a rock. I'll never forget this experience. I flipped this rock, and what was underneath that rock was four times the size. It was longer and massively thicker than any salamander I've ever seen, and it was blazing bright red.
Was it a red salamander?
Spots on it, the northern red. Yeah. Pseudotriton rubra, and it just blew my mind and was like, if this thing exists in the wild, I need to know more, you know? And I was like probably 8 or 9 when that happened. Yeah.
Well, that is awesome. I eat my words now. you know, and I'll say this, and I don't want to get into this tangent because you and I could talk herps forever, whatever the direction.
Yes.
But I was just talking to a guy who said he's got a picture, and he swears up and down he knows the salamanders. He's got a picture of a spring, of a Delco spring salamander.
Oh yeah, it's real.
That's but dude, real there's thing. No records. It would be a county record.
You sure about that?
I was checking in the PARS. The PARS records. Like they said, even prior to the existence of the Pennsylvania Amphibian Reptile Survey, there appear to be no, at least according to them, and they usually build on the museum records and whatever's in VertNet and that kind of thing.
There's a guy named Dave Fitzpatrick who's a rad local guy who I think had. What's that? I'm pretty sure he had a bead on him. Maybe I'm wrong.
All right. Well, in any case, cool news, even if it's an exists older record, it's something I'd love to chase down sometime. But to start off, you know, we were thinking there's a lot of ways to attack this topic. And we're going to look at it a few different ways over a few episodes. But I was wondering, Mike, if you would read from a classic, and I'll give a little background on this before you jump in, from a book on the topic called Salamanders of the Family Plethodontidae by Emmett Reed Dunn, published in 1926. Now this is, it's a comprehensive monograph. It's incredibly useful and valuable, but doesn't make great reading. And as Dunn was talking about it, writing it involved countless hours of sorting through thousands of preserved specimens, cataloging all the little minute ways that like one species of salamander differs from another. And in the foreword to the book, Dunn takes a few pages to remind himself and the readers that even if writing it was like total drudgery, the field work that went into collecting all those specimens and observing them was awesome. So we're going to start a few paragraphs in, and after that, we'll jump back into the conversation. Mike, you ready?
Yeah, I am. And so just ahead of time, this writing is from the 20s. So some of the prose itself is a little interesting, and some of the locations, I might screw the name up a bit, so please forgive me in advance.
You're ready? Awesome either way.
All right, here we go. For every specimen of the 12,000 and odd about which this book has been written was taken in the field by collectors who found them on their own land and close to their own homes and discovered strange creatures in familiar places, or by collectors who half a world away from their own country met places and animals and men that they had not seen. They were dull and not the work if there was not for them some thrill therein.
Yeah.
153 times some one of these creatures has been described as new, And whether in the field or in museum, in the recognition of a novelty as it was first divulged to intelligent and appreciative eyes, there has come a peculiar and high satisfaction. Highest, of course, when the collector realizes that he has caught and holds in his hands an unknown animal. Only less high when home from the hunt, he finds a new beast among his spoils, and high enough when envisaging the spoils of another, he sees among them one strange to him and to science. Nor is a novelty necessary. Many and one has dreamed for some rare creature and has traveled far and known much discomfort in search thereof, and the final meeting is overpayment. Conrad, in the 20th chapter of Lord Jim, has depicted the appropriate emotions, and Stein felt that there were many another has felt elsewhere. It is not in the collecting of specimens, in the observing of habits, in the examination of museum material, or in the search through literature that one encounters ennui. Rather, it is after all the material is at hand and all the information is gathered that the unalloyed drudgery begins. Do you want me to go on?
Oh, yeah.
Great. Now that the drudgery is over, I can remember how puzzling the first few specimens of the commonest species were to me, and how I foolishly imagined that the first grown males of Desmognathus fuscus, which is Northern Dusky, my goodness. I'm just going to stick to the Latin. And that I caught and examined were the desiderate Lorignathus, because they too lack teeth on the prevomers. Interesting. And I can remember that first gigantic specimen of Quadrimaculatus that I took at Brevard.
That's a hell of a salamander.
Yeah. And how I saw for the first time Gutto lineata in the light of an electric torch, and it was climbing on a bush, and how it leapt violently down deep into a deep ditch and was lost to me. And how many days before I ever saw another. And I remember Plethodon Metcalf at Sea Off, when half the ridges of the southern Appalachians rode in dark blue waves across the French Board Valley, and how few of them there were on that barren windswept crest, and how on the slopes of the Grandfather,
Great Mountain.
Some chance-turned log disclosed the red band on the back of a Yanalosi. And I knew that an unknown species was before me.
Yes.
I can remember climbing White Rock on a special trip for Jordan and I, which I had never seen. And I climbed 1,000 feet before I saw the first, but I had 37 when I came down. And this is back when you pickled them, right? You're bringing all these samples home with you.
Well, he was collecting, man, yeah.
Yeah, collecting, these species weren't described yet, some of them at least. At Navarro, there was a big gray robustus that lived in the fallen tree in the forest and in a pasture near Jalapa amongst stone. What's that?
Jalapa,
yeah, all right. Among stones at the foot of a tree, the pair of black and golden bell eyes. I remember how the snake and I saw at La Loma when I turned the leaf and it slid into the water, changed into Colaris when I caught it. Or how I came by night upon the type of Otapus colineus. Yet it is the places that stick in my mind, which I had not seen but for Desmognathus or for Otapus. Cedar Rock, in the rain, when in the face of it all was a waterfall, 1,000 feet high and 1/2 mile wide, water pouring out from the spruce forest on top and spreading out over the great dome and down the mighty roaring to its hidden base. The cliffs of Lost Cove and the escarpment of the Blue Ridge, down which we went all one long day, with our senses of direction clean gone and dark came on, and we followed trails in the woods which ended blindly, until across 3 ridges we heard a cowbell and the bark of a dog. I've been, luckily, in places that remote where it's actually nice to hear the hum of a highway, because you know you're not lost forever. You
know? I know that feeling.
it's wonderful. It's pretty hard to get lost these days. Everything is so well mapped. the silence of the spruce forest on White Top and the thick moss on the ground there.
I'll interrupt to say I was on that mountain a couple times in the past few months. It is gorgeous, great. And we'll talk about it in another episode. Go ahead.
Great, great. The rocky pool on White Rock with the Tennessee Valley 3,000 feet below. The Cumberland Front, a dim line to the west. Goyot, and Clingman's Dome looming up through the mist that hung along the line of the Smokies. When all there was between me and the Richland balsams was miles of air and a hawk soaring. Oh. Yeah. Coming into the port of Limon with the pelicans and frigate birds rattling by on their coarse wings, and a look to them as if they had been drawn by Doré. The oak forest of Irazu, when our horse hooves made no sound, so they're on horseback in the mountains in somewhere in Central America.
Yeah.
The soft ash, and the leaves of the oaks were gray from the ash, and it was very silent as we rode. Until about dusk, the wind swooped from behind the shoulder of the volcano, very cold with a cold rain, and we stopped to put on our ponchos, looking back and far below, where the lights were coming in on Cartago and Parazio, cities of the plain. Riding by night from Alajuela to San Pedro de Poas, over bridges across torrents which roared and were white in the moonlight. Sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah.
On the top of a train with Mexican soldiers riding from Xico to Jalapa, when Cofre de Perote towered above us like some misshapen lion, and the white cone of Orizaba rose above hill after hill as the train went by. And events not wholly connected with salamanders come into my mind, and no need of effort of recollection. The heave of the earth and the glimpse of underfires in the aforementioned eruption of Irazu, the fertilance at the ford of Bananito, when I picked up the bridle of a mule and a 6-foot snake with it. Exciting. The first time I heard the red howlers alone in the woods above Navarro. Night at La Loma and something coughing, and Celso who said, aquí viene el tigre? Or more so, aquí viene el tigre, right?
That image of nighttime and something coughing in the dark, you know, it's just, ugh. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah, and you know, it's a jaguar.
Yeah.
The peons, drunk and fighting on payday at Guapiles. The sudden appearance of 40 horsemen with rifles and bandilleros one night at Sierra de Gallo. And the terrible wariness along the path to Tlamacas. Places and happenings, people and animals, wind at sea and on mountains, and all that I remember. It was no unpleasant path I trod when I followed this questing beast, or that, nor have all of them been unattainable. And with this aforementioned, and with this forward, I commend the remainder to the reader, who will, I doubt not, turn elsewhere before many pages. Bueno vaya usted con Dios.
So that passage has a certain, like, special status among people who get into reptile and amphibian writing. We will talk about the biology of things, right? We'll talk about the animals and how cool they are. And I don't need to tell Mike this as someone who goes out into the woods and into the fields for a living. But even if you're out there, let's say if you're going to be out there looking for at grassland birds or whatever you're doing, the experience of it is something so much more. You know, when I'm flipping rocks to try to find a life or a salamander, and I'm doing it in the Blue Ridge and it's gorgeous, or if I'm like on a mountain in the Smokies in the morning and you see why they're called the Smokies, because you look across and it looks like an ocean of cloud with a few mountains popping up, you know?
Right.
I could go on for a while, man.
Yeah, man. I'll add to that very briefly. I just recently got my lifer prairie king snake in Kansas a couple of weeks ago, and it was through a lot of road cruising at night. And I eventually got so exhausted, I just pulled over the truck in the farmland, just out in the prairies, and opened the bed of the truck and just laid down and slept in the bed of the truck I could barely fall asleep because of the coyotes howling, 30 plus coyotes, and the Chuck Wills widow that decided to be on the road 10 feet from where I must have parked in his territory.
Those are wild suckers, yeah.
And then woke up to this amazing chorus of grassland birds. You know, it was unforgettable. So, yeah.
Awesome. All right. So it's hard. We should have ended with that because it's hard to follow it. But let's talk about the salamanders. All right. So I'll give some basic background information about Desmognathus. I forget how much you just said in that in 1926 or 100-something species. These days...
153 is what he said.
Last I checked, it's around, it's a little less than 480. So,
my goodness.
And almost all of them are in Central North America. These are salamanders that tend to be small. Most species are only a few inches long, and they completely lack lungs. Basically, they use their skin to get rid of carbon dioxide and to bring in oxygen, sort of what we do with our lungs when we breathe, but they do it through their skin.
And also, I mean, chemoreception, more than just oxygen, more than just respiration through their skin, right?
Fair point. They do allow through skin. I was reading it, a lot of this, and the family has distinctive little ridges.
Nasolabial ridges, yeah.
And so those are apparently full of sensory cells, they're used, it sounds kind of funny, man, I didn't think about this, but they're used to kind of drain the nostrils a bit because they don't breathe in and out of their nostrils. Because they don't breathe.
In any case,
they have some other things in common with it. So they, because of their, like most, this is true for most amphibians, but especially when you're small and your skin is really important for respiration, they tend to be in moist habitat or at least moist microhabitats and moist conditions in general. So you'll see them, if you see them out and about, it's going to be on a rainy night rather than in the middle of a hot, sunny day.
And this is why, because they rely on moist conditions, water quality is absolutely important for some more so than others. So certain species can be significant indicators of ecosystem condition.
Yep. All true. I'm trying to decide how much to jump into that topic, but let's hold that for a sec because see what time we got. A lot of them have tongues that they can sort of shoot out and grab things with. Let's talk a minute about sex, Mike, and salamanders.
Let's talk about all the good things.
Salamanders have sex through, or they do internal fertilization, right? So they're not like frogs that. That shoot their eggs out, shoot the sperm out in the water. It all right. Mixes together and it works out, right? No. What salamanders do is the males put down a clump of sperm in something called a spermatophore, and the females pick them up with their cloacas, and that's how fertilization happens.
But so it's still a lackluster if you anthropomorphize. It's still like, hey, I'll leave this here for you. Feel free to pick it up and fertilize some eggs.
But it gets more fun than that. I think you're selling them short. The trick then is not, if you think of mammalian terms, how do you get your sex organ inside the female, right? Like the question is, how do you convince the female to pick something up, right? And so what they do. With these salamanders, a lot of what it is to mate is to have a special dance, sort of to get the female lined up with you and kind of dance along with her, like following you in the right way, so that she's right there when you put down the spermatophore. And then something else that they do, and this is sort of the chemical side of it, is that male, I think certainly the genus Plethodon, now I'm not sure if it applies to all plethodontids, but they have a gland under their chin that produces pheromones, and they have little, almost tusks or fangs. And the males will scratch the skin of the female in courtship and then smack the scratch with the gland and sort of inoculate her with sex pheromones. So it's sort of an aphrodisiac thing. In human terms, it would be kind of like drugging someone. But this is how salamanders do it. It's funny, Gigi and I this was for a nerd night that my wife, who then worked at a museum, and long story, but I was giving a presentation about salamander sex. And the way we did it is Gigi and someone else who worked there dressed up as salamanders, kind of, and then acted out the different mating dances of different kinds of salamanders. I wish I had that recorded. That was a fun night.
That's fantastic. How did you not record that?
I don't know. I remember Tony worked the slides for me, and it was at a beer garden that Tony hates. And so I felt bad because he was like, yeah, I'll do it. And he's like, where is it? I'm like, look. And he still came. That shows he's a good friend. And I was reading about Desmognathus. So Desmognathus or accents, I always have a hard time with the Latin or the scientific names, but we were talking about the Duskies a little while ago. It's a genus of incredibly confusing salamanders.
In the Plethodontidae family, right?
Yep, in the Plethodontidae family. And what is distinctive about Desmognathus, I had forgotten about this. They open their mouths, not by, like we do, dropping our jaws. They flip their head up and keep the lower jaw relatively...
Yeah, the lower mandibles fixed, right?
Yeah, crazy. Sorry. I know. These are the things that we think are crazy. I was going to say that, the first salamander I found was a redback salamander in the Wissahickon. And at the time, I was a kid. This is a big park in Philadelphia. I grew up in Central Ohio, but my family my family's from Philadelphia, so we come to visit. I thought I had found something called a slimy salamander, which is black with a lot of flecks on it.
Also a plethodontid.
Also plethodon glutinosis. And in this case, it turned out it was a dark phase of the redback.
Yeah.
But I still remember that as a fun first find.
Plethodon cinereus was my first found salamander too. Shortly followed by Eurasia bislineata, and then the one that captured me forever, Pseudotriton rubra.
Way more spectacular. And I think, I don't know how much longer we'll go on this particular introduction podcast. I want to make a couple little extra points that I think that I was surprised by. Mike, did you know that there are plethodontid salamanders, we know them as being one of the gems of North American and Central American diversity. And we like to brag about, especially the Southern Appalachians.
Yeah, the Appalachians in general, but especially the Southern Appalachians, we harbor the most biodiverse, it's the most biodiverse region for salamanders on the planet.
Yeah. And I have the air conditioning off because I don't want to have the noise in the background, so I keep mopping myself with a bandana. You have another, like, not quite as diverse or not quite as speciose, but we have another sort of center of diversity in Central America for the same group of salamanders.
Right. Hence the description done. Yeah.
Exactly, the bellii. Yeah, no, it's I think it's pseudo Eurasia bellii.
Whoa, pseudo Eurasia.
I know. it's not a two line, it's something else.
But it's probably. So there's probably some convergent evolution, right? They probably prefer similar habitat types, maybe have similar morphologies.
You know? Yeah, I was looking at like the way they lump the species and the plethodontids, and it seems like the Eurasia and pseudo Eurasia are in the same, I don't know, clade or however you put it. But I had no idea before I was poking around for this episode. Number one, that there are plethodontid salamanders in Europe. That there's a cluster of species in Italy, Sardinia, southern France.
Mountainous region.
Yeah. And sort of they're called cave salamanders, but they also occur outside the caves. But they look kind of like a green salamander, like a whatever the which is the kind of salamander we have in Pennsylvania as well as
only in southern and western PA. Yeah.
And then in 2004, I think, someone described a plethodontid salamander from Korea.
Wow. And
it, which if you're thinking of the globe, I mean, we got like we got these salamanders that are super abundant, diverse in North America. We got one little pocket of them in Europe, and then Korea. It's sort of it's a bizarre distribution.
That's pretty wild. Can we take a moment to celebrate why the plethodontidae are so diverse in at least in North America? I don't know the story on these other. I would imagine a mountainous orogenies.
I think it's similar. So do you want to talk about the island effect, my friend?
Yeah, I mean, do you want to do it? I mean, go for it. All right, cool. So, I mean, this is one of the things that blew my mind, and it's easy when you grow up in the eastern part of the United States to take eastern redback salamanders for granted, Plethodon cinereus, right? They're very common. In some areas, their biomass rivals just about anything else in the forest. You know, they could have 1 square meter territories, and just about every log you roll, you'll find one. And so
it adds up.
Yeah, it does. It surely does. But so here's the cool thing about Plethodon today and why they've become so diverse. They've radiated, essentially. So here's your standard Plethodon cinereus, this gorgeous little fella.
Yeah.
And quickly, just a quick 101 on an amphibian. What defines an amphibian? In Greek, amphibios means dual life, right? So these, in general, amphibians require a water body, and typically the eggs they lay are in the water body, and then the larvae that hatch out are fully aquatic, and then they metamorph similar like frogs, right? The easiest way to explain this to a child or someone that's typically disinterested is to think about a frog life cycle. The adults can go in and out of water, but the young, be it the tadpole or whatever, are fully aquatic. So, and then there's some examples that flip it, right? Notothalmus viridescens does it the other way. The adults are fully aquatic.
And we'll point out juvenile, that it's not a plethodontid, but still a way cool salamander.
Yeah, not a plethodontid, but but it's in the amphibian world.
Yep.
But so here's the cool thing about plethodontidae. They have managed to cheat that, right? These little guys, yes, here, you can roll one log and easily find 4 or 5. And here you see the leadback variety in with the redbacks as well. So a little morphological variation. So here's the cool thing. These plethodontidae have figured out a way to lay eggs in rotting wood, in coarse woody debris, and the juveniles come out as miniature replicas of the adults. You can find a 3 or 4 millimeter long animal that looks just the same as those ones that were in Billy's hand in that photo.
Yeah.
So that's mind-boggling.
Hey, Mike, we're having a little bit of connection problem real here.
So,
but now you're sounding good again. Keep going.
Because of that, they could traverse far into woods away. They're not errant species. And this is how old these things are. They were here before the North American and the African.
Wait, sweetie.
Sorry, we dropped the connection there, folks. Sorry about that.
Where'd you lose me?
You were talking about how they were here before the Appalachians rose up.
Yeah, so the Appalachians were created when two continental plates collided, the North American and the African continental plates. The Appalachians are some of, if not the oldest mountains on the planet. They used to be as dynamic and as tall as the Andes. And New Jersey can basically thank the Appalachians for weathering over millions of years, right? You know, but the Piedmont and the
all the sand that got washed off the mountain.
Yeah, exactly, right. As these were weathered by wind and rain, it's leveled them out. And now they look like these gorgeous rolling hills. But they used to be these huge dynamic things. So anyway, once that happened, these salamanders had elevational limitations. They'd get stuck within a river valley or up on a mountaintop. And so the same parent species radiated and speciated over many thousands of years into what now is, I don't know, how many hundreds of species, right? It's really astounding.
And you see, and this is something we'll get into more, and I'm thinking we have about a minute or two left, I think, of call. So I'll just wrap up real quick and say, we're going to see a lot of this. So we're going to see a lot of salamanders that that whose habitat might have been much more widespread, let's say in glacial maximums and that kind of thing. And then as temperatures warm and their spruce forests creep up the mountains, all of a sudden they're stuck on little islands on top of these mountains, right? And so it's and all this stuff drives speciation. And so this is why we have such great diversity of them. So I think the time is upon us to wrap up. Is what happens when you get the free version of Zoom. But Mike, have a wonderful trip out to the Great Plains.
Thank you. Prairie potholes for the next couple of weeks and then Great Plains on the way back. Yep.
Awesome. All of it awesome. Yeah. And we will keep talking about salamanders and lots of other stuff, all right? So take it easy, even if herping ain't.
And you know it ain't. Herping ain't easy, baby.
All right. Take care, man.
All right, take it easy, brother. All right, so long.